for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Cyber attacks, ethnic tensions abroad, climate change. Sounds like an agenda for the president. They're also the problems John Hunter's fourth grade students tackle when they play the world peace game. He developed it 35 years ago. Over the decades, not only has the game evolved, it's caught the attention of the Pentagon and the UN. Here to talk about the world peace game and how it's informed his views on education and teaching, John Hunter. His new book is titled World Peace and Other Fourth Grade Achievements. And throughout the hour, I'll look forward to hearing from you. Join us by phone at 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Welcome to you, John.
Oh, thank you, Diane, so much for having me.
So, 35 years ago, what set you to thinking about this?
Well, you know, Diane, it was actually not having a directive. When I first became a teacher, my first supervisor, I asked her, what should I do? I wanted to do a good job, and she simply stunned me. She said, what do you want to do? And that was so surprising, so shocking. And I really entered the first year of teaching with no map, no guideline, no mandate. And I had to simply create out of that empty space something for the students. And of course, I had been instructed earlier in college to think about their passions, what they loved and cared about, and build curriculum to and around that. So that was really the beginning of it in 1978.
And what did you come up with early on?
Well, they had to. The curriculum required they study Africa. So I had to teach that. That was our hard limit. That was a given. And I knew that their passion in 1978 was board games. We didn't have Facebook or Twitter or anything, so it was only board games. And I think problem solving had just been invented around that time as a technique. So I included those things together, sort of a, I guess you'd call it a mashup, and came up with the first world peace game, a 4-foot-by-5 plywood board on the floor populated with hundreds of little game pieces and a map of Africa outlined. And I thought, well, let's solve all the problems of the continent. And the students, not knowing that we couldn't or we weren't allowed to, just began to do it. And it became the game, and that was the beginning.
So what does it look like now? It's far more sophisticated.
Yeah. It's evolved, and I will say the students have given suggestions, but one night about 2 a.m. in the morning, I just had this insight because I kept pushing, how can this be better? How can it require deeper engagement? And suddenly I saw the entire structure there in my mind. It was a 4-foot-by-4-foot-by-4-foot plexiglass tower. There were four horizontal sheets of plexiglass, 4-foot-by-4-foot, 1/4-inch thick, and they were stacked vertically above one another so that the whole structure rose to about 4.5 feet. It towers over my 9-year-olds in my fourth grade classroom. And so that was a structure. And of course, every level emulated something of the Earth. There was the undersea level, the ground and sea level, the aircraft level, and the outer space level. And then I arranged teams or cabinets around the board to begin solving the world's problems in a 3D sort of fashion.
So I want listeners to know that if they go to our website, drshow.org, you can see photographs and even a video of this game. So what do the kids do? One thing that you read to them early on. Set this up for us and, well, let's hear it first.
So Sun Tzu's first two quotes, and these quotes are contradictory. Here they are. The first one is, he says, there is no instance of a country having benefited from prolonged war. You might have read about some things in the news along this line too, whether things have gone on too long in certain parts of the world in warfare now. Second quote from Sun Tzu, it is only one who is thoroughly acquainted with the evils of war that can thoroughly understand the profitable way of carrying it on.
Tell me why you chose those passages to begin every game.
Well, you know, Diane, the students really brought that to me. One of the students came in and said, my mother reads this book. She's a businesswoman. She reads it every night. And I think we could use it in the game. So I brought it to the students, as I always do, and we discussed it, decided to use it. And I will go through that little manual before every session and pull some pertinent quote and just allow a moment of reflection afterwards for the students to think about what this 2,500-year-old Chinese general is proposing. They say he's a man of war, but we really learn to use the manual as a way to arrive at peace. It's kind of counterintuitive, but students learn what not to do and how not to do it in their own way, in their own time, without me teaching it or preaching it.
You know, it does go back to your own development, even before you became a teacher. Tell us about that.
Well, Diane, I grew up in the segregated South in the 60s. My mother was a school teacher who actually taught me in the fourth grade. My father was a very great spatial, tactile thinker. He was a mechanic. And together, the family home was very quiet. There was kind of a peacefulness. And I even now call it an empty space where things were allowed to flourish and develop before we had to address them. So that habit of pausing and reflection and introspection was allowed and supported, and answers were rarely given. We would be asked, what do we think, and consider this for a while, and think about it and reflect on it. So we'd have to come to our own decision, our own conclusion, and of course our parents would support or guide that, but there was so much space allowed in that, and I sort of followed that in developing my own teaching habit, I think.
You finished high school and then began and dropped out of
yes,
college.
Several times.
How many times?
I think three times I dropped out of college.
Why?
Well, you know, I didn't feel comfortable. I didn't feel there was anything of any meaning or value. Nowadays, I laugh at that. But I thought there was a bigger world, and I had to be a part of it now. So where were things happening in the early 70s? It appeared that the interesting place was India, and this deep introspection in the philosophy and contemplation. So I had to go. So I'd drop out and buy a ticket and go to India and roam around for months. And finally, I came back the last time after my trips, and my mother and father just begged me, please, just finish a degree in something. We don't care what it is. Just finish. We know you'll need this tool. And so I reluctantly went back to the college and did reinstate and finished a degree in early childhood education, as a matter of fact.
You weren't even sure what that was going to be.
I had no idea. I knew that I registered for an experimental program, which caught my interest to come to the university for the final time. Because of that word experimental, I went. I didn't know what it was about. It could have been dentistry. It could have been anything. But it happened to be an education. And so I was happily in the unknown. But yet the word experimental was my guide.
So what you did was take that empty space that you had as a child growing up to think, to contemplate, to consider what the next step was going to be. And you use the metaphor of an empty space for the game. What do you mean there?
That's right, Diane. The ability or the opening to allow time for reflection and time to mull over and ruminate and contemplate. You know, in our modern culture, we don't really have enough time. Things are coming at us so fast from so many directions, particularly our young children, that they hardly have time to digest and reflect and understand at a deeper level. So I knew I had to build in some time as things were speeding up over the decades. So we allow reflection or allow experiences and learning that put the students in a place where we don't know the answer. They've got to ruminate, reflect, and contemplate possibilities, and even try and fail. We train for failure because that's a part of life as well. So allowing all those open spaces where things might not go well, things might turn out differently, that's a great and deeper part of learning, I believe.
Tell me how the game begins. How do the kids get named to their various posts?
Sure. Well, they come in the room, and first they're overwhelmed with the structure. They don't know what it is or what we're getting into. There is absolutely no preparation, vocabulary, history, anything before they come in. I believe they should start cold from zero on equal footing together. And I will choose the leadership. Each cabinet has a prime minister, a secretary of state, a minister of defense, and a CFO or chief financial officer. The UN has a UN secretary general. The World Bank has a president and a CEO and CFO. And, of course, we have the arms dealers, the president of that company, too. So I'll choose a leadership based on my intuitive understanding of what each student needs. And they in turn choose their cabinets. And they choose anyone. I advise them not just to think about their friends, because their friends may not be the best person for those jobs. And once they have their cabinet set, I give them 50 interlocking global problems, sort of ripped from the headlines and modified for children. And we use fictional countries. We don't use real countries, because I found early on students simply copied solutions that their parents or the news services were supplying. So we actually give them a chance, an open space to develop their own country, and then they come at it from a different, fresher angle, I think.
So when they begin, you give them a problem. Give me an example.
Well, actually, they get all 50 at once. The idea is to overwhelm them with complexity. We don't pre-chew in bite-sized bits, as we might have been taught earlier as teachers, that children's mind can't handle anything but a little bit at a time. So they're given the entire sequence all at once. And we try to break the problems into various problems that resonate in the world. We have sort of ethnic and religious and minority tensions, water rights problems, and so forth. One particular one I love, and it's so interdependent. We have a very poor, ice-locked country, and they have an island offshore where oil has just been discovered. Their people are facing famine. They need funding and revenue right away. So they're tempted to go and just drill. But there's a microscopic life form right on that site. If they drill, they have a choice to make. Are they going to cause extinction of this life form? Or are they going to use the oil revenue to feed their people? Meanwhile, another country, very ecologically oriented, has surrounded that island, has invaded their territorial water space, surrounded the island, and said, no, you will not drill. Meanwhile, another country offers to buy the island outright from the owners and say, we're going to just take it over and do what we want to do. And then, of course, at the end, we can't even find what the treaty is to say whether or not it's owned by those people.
John Hunter, he's an award-winning teacher. His new book is titled World Peace and Other Fourth Grade Achievements. Stay with us. And here's a message from our website. Michelle writes, I first met Mr. Hunter online as a TED speaker. In a system bogged down in testing, he's a beacon for those of us in the trenches still trying to work with vastness and tools that might save us all. I love him for his naive hope that this can still happen. Is it a naive hope, do you believe?
Well, you know, Diane, we have to have it. Otherwise, you know, what's the alternative? And I think the open vista that children present, that they can become anything, that we can't afford to write off even one child. It may be the child who comes up with a cure for Alzheimer's or who ends poverty and hunger. We have to include them all. And so with that hope burning, all teachers know what I'm talking about, we have to go as if this is going to be the way, this is going to work. There's no other way. We have to just consider them all.
Now, we have an example here of a heated exchange between two prime ministers. Let's hear it.
Okay, we'll start then with Prime Minister Cohn. Will you stand and say who you speak on behalf of, and let us hear your declaration,
sir. I speak
sir.
On behalf of Paxland and the Nins. This is part of the Nins, and the Nins are part of Paxland, so this is basically owned by Paxland.
Are you saying Paxland now owns part of Isania, is what you're claiming, sir? Is that correct?
I am Prime Minister Thompson of Isania. I did not offer it to Paxland. I offered it to Stefan as a homeland, which had no part of Paxland at all. I offered it as a, we'd offer it as he could have land as a homeland, but I did not offer it to Paxland. I offered it to Stefan. I offered it to the Nins leader only. I did not offer it to Paxland, right, which I'm trying to explain.
Can we work this out in negotiation time? You might want to call a UN mediator in on
yeah,
this.
Yeah, I would like to do that.
See, I mean, this whole thing sounds pretty complex and even confusing for an unintended-year-old.
Absolutely, and it should be. It should be so confusing they have to figure it out. And I don't even know how they're going to do that. But I've allowed them, even the heat in this situation you just heard, to be up at the edge of the precipice. Of course, as a teacher, you have to be concerned about safety, psychic and physical. So you're prepared to catch them if they're really going to step off the edge. But you allow them to go up to that space to test their limits, push the envelope. And it's all governed by the underlying relationship. We know where we're going to go. We know how far we're going to go because we love and trust and care for each other. We built that environment to start.
That love and trust may exist as the game begins, but it sounds as though there's some real divisiveness there.
Absolutely, and it's designed in. The game is designed to fail massively. They're allowed to be human. I even tempt them to be reactive, to be impulsive, to look at the darker side of things and yet still go through it and come out the other side experientially, rather than saying, no, this is the right way, please don't even think about that. I found out I short-circuit the learning by telling them no and what the right answer is up front. And in this game, I don't even know what the right answer is. They have to discover it. And Diane, they always come up with taking care of each other and compassion. I don't even have to teach it. I didn't know that was going to happen, but they always find a way to include everyone in their calculations, ultimately.
You said it was on a trip to China where the game really took place in your mind. What happened?
Well, I was on a train going up to Shanghai. I think I was in Guangzhou at the time. And two Chinese girls came into my car. They wanted to practice their English. They were coming from Hong Kong to visit grandmother in the summertime. And so we talked for 4 or 5 hours on the train. And finally, one question they asked me at the end really stumped me. It struck me. They said, "Sir, where do you belong? Who are your people?" And because I'd been so multicultural and had been in so many parts of the world and considered myself a world citizen, that question really unnerved me a bit. And I had to really think about nationalism and patriotism all those kinds of local issues we think about that make us belong to a certain people.
And what about race?
Oh,
did that come into your thinking?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I was in the vanguard of a small group of students who were sent to integrate schools in 1967, 68. We didn't know what was going to happen. It was sort of paralleling the race to the moon that the U.S. was trying to take astronauts to the moon, and none of us knew if we were coming back safely. But we had to go. It was a mission we had to undertake to see if we could expand and deepen the world that way for our people, for our race at the time. And now we found we're all one race. That's strange.
How did you come to give the TED Talk, and how did the clips that we're hearing, by the way, are from a documentary about you and the World Peace Game? The documentary is called World Peace and Other Fourth Grade Achievements. How did all that come about, John?
Well, Diane, you mentioned a great part of the story, and this was in 2006. A mutual friend introduced me to Chris Farina. Chris Farina is an independent filmmaker with the Rosalia Film Company in Charlottesville, Virginia. And he came and he said, I'd like to just observe this game. So he stayed for about a year watching this 8 to 10 week exercise. And he said, "I'd like to make a film." And I watched a couple of Chris's other films, Main Street, and I believe it was Route 40, quietest sort of approaches to things. And I said, "If you can take quietest approach into this world peace game chaos, you're welcome to it." So we made a film. We never knew it would do anything. He submitted it to South by Southwest. It got great reviews. The Bergen International Film Festival took the film abroad. Chris and I were there. We were mobbed by high school students at the screenings who wanted to be teachers because of the film. Chris made a film that's not just about me as a teacher. It became a film about teaching and teachers in general. And that was such a great thing. I saw myself disappear, and I saw my mother and all my teachers, whose shoulders I'm standing on, appear through me. So Chris made a beautiful document to the profession, really. And so we're just using that. And one day we get a call from Chris Anderson at TID, you know, technology, entertainment, and design. And I was a nobody. I'm a small-town school teacher. Chris is an independent filmmaker from a small town. Suddenly we're on a world stage in Long Beach, California, and we give a talk that seemed to resonate. And, you know, we're just doing our best to try and share the work and share the information. And it took off from there.
How do you think that this game could apply in other areas of teaching?
Well, you know, in teaching, of course, the game is designed to be interdisciplinary. So you've got math, you've got science, you've got arts, everything we can get our hands on in the one game. And I know a lot of teachers are taking that approach. We've got to make sure we're solving for X. We don't know what our students are going to be doing in the future. We can't even imagine what they're going to face. How do you teach to that? How do you teach for something that you as a teacher cannot imagine or see? You've got to find a way. And so we build conceptual toolkits that can be used in any situation, under any circumstance, because they're going to have to deal with something we may not live to see, and it's going to be even more important. I mean, looking at the state the world's in now, they're going to be our hopes, our only hopes, to pull things out of this deep past we find ourselves in.
Now, I'd like to hear a couple of students speaking.
Mr. Hunter really sometimes frustrates me when I say, can I do this? And he says, anything can happen. But he never, ever answers your question deliberately.
Why do you think he does that?
He doesn't.
He wants us to learn.
And,
he wants us to learn to
and
solve our own questions.
When you're a grown-up, you can't ask anybody, and they won't tell you what to do. You have to figure it out on yourself.
Figure it out on yourself.
You have to figure it out on yourself.
Isn't it so?
So these kids are at one and the same time frustrated and enlightened by the fact that you do not answer a question.
Well, I don't answer, Diane, because often I don't know the answer. And this is what I admit to them right up front when we meet. Boys and girls, I don't know the answer to everything. You're going to have to help me. And just that simple sentence actually empowers the entire classroom to feel that they are teachers and we are co-teachers together. I have 30 co-teachers in a room. They're half my height, and they all have immense and unique wisdom. And together, putting our heads together, we come up with solutions for things that I, as a singular teacher, could never do. And so I've learned to respect that and to some extent, cede control of the learning to them. I ask them, what shall we do whenever we have something we must do? How shall we do it? And how might we fail? Let's look at that before we even begin. And how will we know we have succeeded? What will success look like? We look at all that up front. That's our backwards design upfront assessment Jay McTighe would talk about. We're trying to get a handle on the whole scope of things, and they're in charge of that, not just me.
How would that apply, for example, to mathematics?
Well, students might be asked about their hobby, their passion. Let's say we have some skateboarders in middle school. That's all they care about. That's all they're interested in. I'm a math teacher. What am I going to do? They're not interested in geometry. But if I show an interest in their passion, so tell me about that skate park. You say you need an inclined plane. What's that? Oh, well, that's this. And you need a ramp? Well, you know what circumference is, right? No. And soon enough, they're deeply involved in geometry and building or designing their own skateboard park based in mathematical principles that they had no interest in a few minutes earlier. You sort of line of least resistance, we call it. You find out what the passion is, and you sneak in with techniques and methods, and their passion powers the learning. They drive the learning with their love of something you've respected and included in the lesson.
And the passage we began this program with from Sun Tzu, how do you get them to read that book and to really understand it?
Oh, well, you know, I don't even have to try. They want to. They see this pocket-sized book with this exciting-looking cover. We know we use it to help ourselves in the game. And they end up buying their own copies and reading them at lunchtime or on the playground at recess. And often the most amazing thing is they'll recontextualize, reinterpret Sun Tzu in their own understanding, which I think is brilliant. They go beyond the set descriptions and definitions that he gives and see it in their own way. And I think that's even a deeper stage of learning than just simply accepting what some authority has told us, to think of it in your own way, in your own understanding. And so they just read it at will whenever they feel like, and they're carrying it around, they're quoting it to each other. It's so exciting to see, and their interpretations are even more exciting.
How do you think that fourth grade experience carries them through?
Oh, Diane, that's the most heartwarming thing. And, you know, it's bittersweet as a teacher when a student leaves your classroom, fifth grade or whatever grade is the top of your school. You may never see them again, ever. And you lay awake at night years after wondering what happened to this one or how that one is doing. So through this game now and through social media primarily, I'm seeing students who played the game 10, 15, 20, 30 years ago coming back to me and telling me specifically, Mr. Hunter, this is what this game did for me. You know, how gratifying. Teachers know what I'm talking about. To have someone who's left you and you put your heart and soul into them and they come back and tell you it made a difference.
How many schools around the country are using this?
Well, we have master classes where I actually offer the understanding about the game to other teachers. And we've had hundreds of teachers come through. I think about 10 of them have adopted it. But, you know, the master classes are only possible because of our partnership. You know, we can't do anything alone as teachers. The Martin Institute for Teaching Excellence in Memphis, Tennessee, Jamie Baker, the executive director, Brad Martin, who founded and funded this institute, have made a partnership with Chris, Farina, and myself to carry this work forward. We couldn't do anything without them.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We're going to open the phones now, 800-433-8850. First to Paragould, Arkansas. Jared, you're on the air.
Hey, Diane. Thanks for having me. I love your show.
Thanks.
I was just calling. I kind of have a simple question, but I think it's simple at least. You were talking about how the children, well, it was obvious when we heard the children get pretty heated and they get into the roles. And I was just wondering if you've noticed as a teacher any sort of innate or natural governmental force coming out. Like, are some children more democratic and some communistic and so on?
That's a great question, Jarrett. You know, because we allow them to go their own way and develop their own understanding, sometimes the game is more rightward-leaning, sometimes it's more leftward-leaning, sometimes it's a group of super-centrists. You know, they have to determine what is the right and proper way for living and surviving and solving these 50 interlocking problems and raising the asset value of every country in the game simultaneously. So really, it's their determination. And over the years, I would say early on I saw more warlike actions, but in the last decade or so, I'd say there's much more a conciliatory behavior, much more foresight in thinking about multiple consequences of every action. They're much more careful, so I have to be much more devious or creative in coming up with ways to push them to consider considerations that they want to easily get out of.
But here's the contradictory element. The game is about peace, and you make war a central component.
Exactly. Because that's like life, Diane. It emulates life. You know, we like to have success always and forever, but life is very wide open and vast and varied. Wherever in our lives do we allow for failure to be a teaching force? We're allowing the students to fail in a safe, appropriate way so they can learn how to handle it, because that's going to be a part of life. It is a part of life. Everything's interdependent, so they must.
Give me an example of how a child might fail playing this game.
Well, in the game here, we have students who are trying to achieve world peace, and often they think war is the way through, and they might go that way for a while. But as in the book, we have one student, Neela, who stands up suddenly just disgusted with our warlike behavior and gives us a lecture on having more compassion. She demands, we have it. Why aren't we doing this? We have to take care of each other. And that failure that we've been missing, we thought it was the right way through. Things were getting worse, actually. Electrifies the room and makes us see there's got to be a better way, because we're losing. We're losing people. We're losing resources. And we're having war. That's certainly a method. But there's got to be another way. And so she let us know that our failure was the way through. So every obstacle, every failure is actually a great opportunity. And they turn the game around almost immediately after that.
And there's a saboteur? Who or what is the saboteur?
It's my greatest piece, I think. Not always, but the student who's often in the office for causing trouble in our school. That's the student I'm looking for. I go to the office and I say to that student, I need to use your skill set. You know, you're so creative. You're in the office all the time for getting in trouble. That creativity I need to use in service of the World Peace Game. So I ask the student to please play their role in the game to try and achieve world peace publicly, but secretly through misinformation, misdirection, innuendo, or even ambiguities and irrelevancies, to please try and destroy this game. That's what they're trying to do. And everyone knows that person's in the room. Nobody knows who it is. But the thinking, the critical thinking must deepen in order for them to survive that, knowing that person's there. And at the end of the game, that person's always celebrated. Thank you so much for making the game so much more challenging for us. We loved it.
What about the principal of the school? How does he or she buy into this?
Well, you know, Diane, you've really got to have buy-in and support from your administrators. Visionary, trusting, and caring leadership is the only way a teacher like I can survive. And so at my school now, Michelle Kastner, for example, she says, I know you, I trust you, I hired you. Do what you must, I'll support you.
John Hunter, his new book is titled World Peace and Other Fourth Grade Achievements. Short break, right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Cancer Treatment Centers of America, offering genomic testing that may reveal other treatment options for individual cancer patients at cancercenter.com. By PBS, with a frontline investigation about life and death in assisted living, tomorrow night at 10 on PBS. And by Inada, maker of the DreamWave massage chair, with body scanning technology and shiatsu point detection. Learn more at dreamwavechair.com. This is NPR.
John Gallagher Jr. starred as Johnny in the Broadway musical American Idiot and also starred in the Broadway musical Spring Awakening. Now he's playing Jim Harper, senior news producer on Aaron Sorkin's The Newsroom. On the next Fresh Air, John Gallagher Jr. Join us.
And if you just joined us, John Hunter is here. He's a fourth grade teacher, and he teaches through a game called World Peace. He's now written a book about his experience, his lifelong learning process. The book is titled World Peace and Other Fourth Grade Achievements. John Hunter, here's a posting on Twitter which says, I work at a school. Does John Hunter travel to schools and inspire other teachers? How can I contact him?
Well, surely through the website that's sponsored by the Martin Institute for Teaching Excellence. That's www.worldpeacegame.org. And that, of course, is part of the partnership where we have our master classes out on the road now all over the world. We were in Norway teaching a couple of years ago. We're going to be in Norway and Austria again next year. And that partnership has been so rich because there's a joy in working with other teachers. But you know, Diane, the thing is, the game, we say the game is not about the game. Really, if you go under the hood and look at the principles underneath the game, the deep meaning and learning and teaching that we hope is behind it, teachers look at that game as a Trojan horse. If you open it up, there's a mirror inside. And teachers, when we show it to them, really see their own deep practices. Mm. And we facilitate their practice going even deeper in these
All
master
right.
classes.
Here are some practical questions for you. Matthew in Cleveland, Ohio, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think this is a wonderful program. I'm very fascinated to be able to listen to the whole thing later as a podcast. But I wanted to ask your guest what he thinks about the National Common Core standards.
What I've done is really stay out of the politics of things. I'm a small town school teacher. I have a limited perspective. I do know that the one thing that guides me is what my principal one time at Venable School, where the film was made, the documentary World Peace and Other Fourth Grade Achievements.
And by the way, that is a public school, not a
I've only
school.
Ever taught in public schools. Yeah. And yeah, I've seen diversity in its finest. And my principal there, Ron Broadbent, I brought him a very convoluted question about a student, how to do it, what should be done, what should the parents be told. And he leaned back in his chair and he said, John, there's only one answer for all your questions as a teacher. How could there be one answer? And he said, the one answer is, do what's best for that child. There is no other answer. And so we have to look at specifics for every individual child. There's no one size fits all. It's impossible. We have to think about the individual, because that's the way we want to be treated as adults. So certainly we should think about our younger people in the same way.
But isn't your public school pressured to meet those Common Core initiatives and standardized testing processes?
We certainly have the standards to go to. And my principal and my superintendent, Pam Moran, take a very pragmatic view, very wise view, I think. My principal said, to all the teachers, I think she said at different times, but to me specifically, she said, I know you, I hired you, I handpicked you. You're a professional, you know what to do. Go and do your absolute best for these children in any way possible. I will support you, I'll protect you, and together we will be able to do this. And every year the scores are tremendous at our school, with 23 different ethnic groups and languages, 650 kids, a free and reduced lunch program, a public school. And it's always been that way, that school.
Here's another Twitter that says, my formal education has come to an end, but listening to John Hunter is making me remember all of my incredible teachers. And another, has John Hunter played the game with students who are not in fourth grade? How can my child play?
Well, you know, actually, the game originated for ninth grade high school students. That's where I started it. And over my career, I've been assigned to different grade levels. So we've worked from fourth grade all the way through now to adults. We play with adults in Norway, a multicultural cast there. So the Martin Institute has facilitated us having master classes involving teachers and occasionally the game itself being played with 30 students from around the world all together in one room for 5 days. And on our website, you can see our summer schedule. Usually it's in the summer we can do these intensives. For next summer, I think we have 3 sites, New Jersey, California, and I believe we're going to be in Tennessee as well. But those are places people might apply to have their children come. And, of course, other teachers are taking this on, too. So.
How many students can you take on at one time?
I like large numbers, Diane. 20 is almost too few for me. I think I've had 35 students successfully play. I think 30 is a good, solid number. You want that confusion, that overwhelming chaos, and the despair that comes with that initially in those initial failures, because the students have to learn to work up and out of and through that, through the experiments of trying and failing.
One thing I do want to talk about the trip you made with your students to the Pentagon.
Oh, my.
How did that come about?
You can imagine how we felt. We were screening the film for a design firm in Silicon Valley, IDEO, Chris Farina and I. And a woman who's very well appointed, very well dressed, came up afterwards and held out her card and said, "Mr. Hunter, we'd like to see you." The card said, "Defense Department, Pentagon." So Chris and I looked at each other and we thought we'd better make some time in our schedule to go see them. Well, Diane, we were ushered into the Pentagon past all that security, and we had a shock, the shock of our lives. We found out that Chris's documentary film, Chris Farina's film, had been screened 4 times at the Pentagon to different policy and military groups. They screened it a 5th time and had a 2-hour deep and moving discussion with us about how to create space, that empty space we were talking about, around problems. We've been at war for 10 years. We've lost friends. We're suffering. We're hurting. We're looking for answers anywhere we can. Please talk to us about that. And, you know, we thought we'd go in and see a heartless war machine. But there they were, people who were suffering. And then I got back home, still in awe, got a call saying, "Mr. Hunter, we'd like for you to bring your 4th grade students to the Pentagon, the ones who just played the game. We'd like to talk to them about how they do what they do." Because they've had peace. They've won the game for 35 years every time they played. So we went in, we got dressed up, and I put them on real-world country desk, the Pakistan desk, the Nigeria desk, the Mexico desk, and they had to come up with a white paper and 3 questions, economic, military, and social, to ask at our mock press conference with the actual Pentagon press briefing secretary. And
wow.
The students stumped him a couple of times, Diane.
Wow.
And then we rushed into, after our tour, the office of then Defense Secretary Leon Panetta.
Wow.
Warm, affable, just
yes.
Grandfatherly. Took off his coat, rolled up his sleeves, and says, "I want to talk to you about policy. This is not a photo op. We want to find out how these children can solve. Here's what we do about climate change. What do you do about it? Here's what we do about insurgents. How do you handle it?" And the students could respond because they had lived through the experience. And it was such a moving moment for a teacher. And then he gave each one of them a coin at the end of the meeting, a signifier of our meeting, a very great honor, actually. And so, you know, those children are changed so deeply. And the fact that even somebody at that level is considering other ways gives us all hope, and is very heartwarming.
Here is to Burke, Virginia. Hi, Kim.
Hi, Diane. Thank you for having me on. I'm a teacher. I've been a teacher for over 20 years. My heart is skipping a beat listening to Mr. Hunter. And I have to say, it makes you think of a million things as a teacher, as a creative teacher, and I have the good fortune to be a resource teacher. So I work with lots of classroom teachers. But then when you step into the reality of what happens in a school, and right now what happens with the push for standard testing and the data-driven everything, you start to feel crushed. And I just want to know how Mr. Hunter deals with this. How do you push on to present something so creative and so interesting and stimulating that all kids should be able to do? And we know that they should be able to do this in the face of people who are often not even teachers telling us that we can't do it anymore and we have to present data as to why everything we do is the right thing to do.
Oh, what a critical question at this time in history. You know, we need assessment. We need some testing to ascertain where we are and what the students have learned. But when that predominates, when that has the most emphasis, learning can become lost. And I know what I've had to do over my career is take the long view and understand that policies come and they go. About every 5 or 7 years, you get this huge new policy coming through. Teachers, you understand. And it's going to change the world. It's going to raise IQ scores. It's going to brighten our teeth. It's going to do everything for us. And it may or may not. Sometimes they're disasters. Sometimes they're okay. But the critical, fundamental thing that always remains is that one-on-one relationship between teacher and student. No matter the policy weather overhead, if it's harsh weather, we pull on our coats, and if it's sunny, we skip about. But the relationship remains, and that's so fundamental. I really wish, I guess you do too, my friend, but that teachers could make policy. We'd like to have experts who know what they're talking about and make policy for other teachers. Wouldn't that be wonderful?
The idea of focusing that one-on-one relationship, however, gets tougher and tougher with larger classrooms.
Mm. It is a challenge, you know. And my principal, Ron Broadbent, also said to me, "John, you're not here for your convenience or your comfort. You're here for these other children, all these children. You'll do whatever it takes because this is a service profession. We're here to serve. It may cost, it may be difficult, it may be hard, it may be unpleasant. If it's too much for you, you need to get out or change schools, change professions, whatever you need to do to preserve yourself, of course, but we're here to serve. And nobody said it's going to be a high-paying job and it's going to be a lot of vacation time. This is something about helping and serving others and developing compassion.
I want to hear one more clip from that film, and then you can tell us what it's all about.
Now I'm feeling really weird because I'm living what Sun Tzu said 1 week. 1 week he said, those who go into battle and win and will want to go back, and those who lose in battle will want to go back and win. And so I've been winning battles, so I'm sort of going into battles, more battles. And I think it's sort of weird to be living what Sun Tzu said.
Again, isn't there some contradiction to winning all the time? These students have always won the game.
Well, you know, Diane, in our book, we talk about the dangers of victory and the benefits of defeat. And they go through many defeats before they arrive at that final victory. They have to experience that side of it, too. So it's not just a rosy, sunny picture all the way through. We're trying to develop global leaders through complex problem solving, communication, collaboration, and developing compassion across cultures.
Compassion is so important.
I keep saying that.
How do these kids exhibit that compassion?
Well, oh, Diane, that's such a moving part. They will do things. We played a game recently in one city where the arms dealers realized that their business, their customers were, they were losing customers because their business was so successful. So they decided to diversify. They liquidated their weapons business and went into energy, farms, and construction. And eventually they became a charity by the end of the game, all on their own. They saw this is the way through. You know, if we eliminate all of our customers, we're not going to be a good business anymore. So logic ruled, and they figured that out themselves. They didn't have to listen to me saying, let's not use weapons, let's be peaceful. They discovered it for themselves, and their compassion led the way through the game.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go now to Charlotte, North Carolina. Hi there, Amy.
Hi, Diane. Hi, Mr. Hunter.
Hello, Amy.
I wanted to tell you that I watched the documentary, and it subsequently made me go to the website and look into this more. But I just wanted to tell you that you are phenomenal. It actually makes me smile listening to the documentary clips again, and what the on the radio show and what the students said and experienced. And I'm just blown away by you and your creativity and how great a teacher you are. And I just wanted to say I commend you. And I'm so happy that we still have teachers like you.
Well, you know, thank you so much for that, but I can't accept it, really. I have to accept it on behalf of my teachers and my colleagues, because what we've seen with the Martin Institute traveling around the country, Jamie Baker and I, is that there are so many great teachers teaching. You know, you see a film or a media piece showing one difficult classroom, one disaster, and you get this idea that everything is going wrong. Well, we've seen it firsthand. There are fantastic teachers everywhere, and they just haven't had the fortune of having a filmmaker come into their classroom and make a movie. But there's so much good going on. I'm so optimistic now, having met hundreds and thousands of teachers doing this great work, the unsung heroes of the profession. So I'm enthused and excited, and I will pass your thanks on to my teachers who made me what I am and brought me here today.
So what's next?
Well, it appears the world's wide open. There's an empty space in front of us, Diane.
Yeah,
but we're going abroad quite a bit.
I know. Empty space.
It's a wonderful thing. Because of the support and the partnership of our Albemarle County Public Schools and all the people there in Charlottesville who support us, and now around the world, we're able to go where teachers would like for us to come and share this work with them. And again, our primary purpose is to inspire them to do their best work. We challenge them to develop the best curriculum they've ever imagined or seen before they leave us. It may be connected to the World Peace Game, it may be not. The game is not about the game. It's about them and their work with their students.
So you're saying that each and every classroom may not wish to use this particular approach, but may develop their own.
It isn't necessary. It's who you are and who your children are. and looking at what their passions are and what you care about and putting that together in your classroom to make the best. This, in spite of testing, in spite of all the assessments required, we're trying to create wonderful, loving human beings. And that, I think, is more the purpose of education. I used to think it was just passing on knowledge. Now I think compassion and caring about others and decreasing suffering is really a major part of our purpose as educators.
And one last caller in Cincinnati, Ohio. Peter, we're almost out of time. Your question, please.
Well, it is parental involvement. I spent my career heading major independent schools. Now I'm helping the Cincinnati Public Schools. And I would guess that Mr. Hunter is in a community where there are professional parents, parents deeply involved in their kids. I hope I'm wrong. I want to be proven wrong. But would he respond to that? I think if he went into the inner city of Washington, D.C., could he do this?
Well, sir, we started, the World Peace Games started in an inner city school in Richmond, Virginia. It was a school, a gifted high school designed for minority students who didn't have a shot otherwise. So my population has always been diverse. It's always been children all across the spectrum, in trouble and on the high end as well. We have some professional parents, of course. We have parents who may not have any connection or wherewithal at school at all. And it's the whole world community is there in public school. We have to take it on, and we do.
John Hunter, his new book is titled World Peace and Other Fourth Grade Achievements. The clips you heard this morning are from a documentary about John Hunter and the World Peace Game. That, too, is titled World Peace and Other Fourth Grade Achievements. Congratulations, and thank you for being here.
Thank you so much, Diane. Thank you.
Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations.